Broadcasting to New York City, Los Angeles, Chicago, Sydney, London, and around the world, this is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us here on Trumpet Radio Live on 101.3 KPCG. Coming up on this Monday edition, Educated in Terror, Deprogramming the Children ISIS Taught to Kill. They've done a lot of damage, including to children. It's an interesting look at some of those events. Also, something interesting over in China, there's four volunteers. They're going to live in a sealed lab for 200 days to get ready to go to the moon. And also, archaeologists have unearthed a 500-year-old Tower of Skulls. Scary, but awesome too. That and more on Trumpet Radio Live.
This is Trumpet Radio Live.
Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Radio Live at 101.3 KPCG. Online, we're at kpcg.fm, and we have a live link at thetrumpet.com as well. If you'd like to follow us on Twitter, please do that at kpcgfm. And any emails you'd like to send, send those along. Comments at kpcg.fm. We're happy to look at those for you. This is the Monday edition. Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau here today. And Grant and I look spectacular. Abraham, though, just in a T-shirt today. But it's because you're working also at the Philadelphia Youth Camp that's ongoing. So you guys have matching shirts for that. You have today off from you're an instructor in canoeing.
Yes.
But yesterday you canoed a lot. How is it going? Everyone's okay? Enjoying it? No fatalities?
Yeah, as far as I know, we haven't lost a camper yet. But yeah, it's a lot of fun. All the young people, they have varying degrees of canoeing skill and experience. And so from my perspective, they've all done a great job, very enthusiastic, especially in the heat for a couple hours canoeing at a time. Just showed a lot of competence too, picking up quickly. And we've had a lot of fun. The lake water is really nice and cool, so the campers find every excuse to jump in it, capsize their canoe just to cool off a little bit.
That's right. It's been warm. Yesterday, well, I don't know what the air temperature was. It was up in the 90s, but they always talk about the real feel, how it feels out there. And it was real close to 100, some places in the state over 100. So it's going to be a warm week. It is nice to get in the water when it is hot like that. Lots of stories to get to today. Here's a couple of sports notes to start with. James Harden, you might remember him, plays for the Houston Rockets and originally the Oklahoma City Thunder. We always liked him when he was here. Fear the beard. He has a giant beard. And now he's really rich. He was rich before, but now he's even richer. He signed a new contract. It's an extension, and now it's the biggest extension or the biggest contract in NBA history. He's going to earn $228 million through the end of his contract, so he'll have a little money to spend. One report noted that the contract equals $500,000 per game. So, you know, you'd have to go back at the end of the day, at the end of the game, and think, did I earn my $500,000 tonight with my 27 points, 8 rebounds, and 9 assists?
Well, if he ever shoots like 3 for 17, he's probably going to try to hand that paycheck back, if he's honest, hopefully.
It's just getting silly, isn't it? I mean, I know they make a lot of the organizations, the teams, the league makes a lot of money, but this is what happens. They just keep pushing it higher and higher. I mean, at what point is it like, hey, you're really good at basketball, but that's enough. Like, we can't pay you any more for it. It's ridiculous. $500,000 a game? It's unbelievable.
Well, plus James Harden, from what I have watched, I haven't watched him as closely as others, but he's, I guess, the franchise player for the Houston Rockets. But he's not on the same level as other players, I would assume, that maybe the top players in the league, but he's making that much money. It's just a bad precedent, but that's kind of what capitalism does. The more people like something, the more money they put into it, the salaries go up. So it's really the people's choice. It's not really the organization's choice.
I've seen this happen a lot over the years in sports, NBA in particular, because NBA has guaranteed contracts. So play, don't play, you're going to get paid. And what happens is guys will sign these huge contracts, and then at some point, no one's even interested in them as a player anymore. It's just a matter of trading around their remaining contract to try to clear space and things like that. There's been lots of guys. There are guys that haven't played in I don't know, 5-10 years, and they're still like finishing up the buyouts. We're going to pay you just to go away. And it always ends up like that for some of these players. And you hear of some guy that's still making, a couple million dollars a year, and he hasn't played in a decade. But they're still paying him. Like the Knicks, they're famous for that. If I could get a contract with the Knicks doing almost anything, it'd be great because they'd pay you way too much for way too long, and you don't have to do anything if their current players are any standard to look at.
The NBA is just a league of regrets. All these GMs, these general managers are so quick to sign guys to these massive contracts that they actually later will call a salary albatross because it's so heavy and it just weighs down the entire team. The next year when they have a chance to sign several all-stars, they regret signing this mediocre guy to a way too large deal. And like you said, they buy guys out. They pay them a little bit less money than what their contract actually said to make them disappear so the salary doesn't stay on the books and then take away their chances to sign other guys.
You know what I think they should do? At the end of every game, no one's allowed to leave until all the players are lined up and they're paid. So you have to, and they have to announce how much they're making tonight. Announce their stats and then give them the check, and see if the crowd boos or if they, because guys have bad games. You still have to give them their $500,000 check, mm-hmm. and it should be really big. It should be like one of those game show checks.
Or if they sit out games,
yes.
To James Harden's credit, though, he doesn't ever do that. He doesn't sit out games for rest, so he's actually playing in the games that he's getting paid for.
Yeah, well, he sits out half of them on the defensive side. That's what they say. That's what the analysts say. One other sports note: there's a tonight. This is, I think, is getting close to the All-Star game for Major League Baseball.
And tomorrow.
Yeah. So tonight's the Home Run Derby, which people are always excited about. And you know, what's kind of neat about the Home Run Derby is some of the players will have their dads pitch to them, which is kind of cool because I'm sure their dads pitched to them a lot growing up. Well, one of the guys that everyone's looking at tonight is a rookie, Aaron Judge. That's a great name. He's a big-time hitter for the New York Yankees. And so he's hitting tonight, and they have some advanced statistics about him, metrics, I guess. The exit velocity, in other words, how hard he hits the baseball and how hard it leaves his bat, it's the highest in professional baseball. The league average is 103.4 miles per hour exit velocity. His is 110.7. So he's over 7 miles an hour faster when the ball leaves the bat. And so that's why he can hit so far. And even if he's not hitting home runs, he rockets those balls back at people.
Think about being a fielder and having those things flying at your face all the time. It's a pretty scary job, especially being over there at third base, or if you're the pitcher, when you're temporarily defenseless after delivering a pitch. A scary job when you have monsters like that hitting the ball.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a huge guy, especially for baseball. He is 6'7", 282 pounds, which is quite large for a baseball player. And but he's had three or four of the hardest hit balls this year that weren't home runs. He hit several. He hit one. The fastest was 121.1 miles per hour. That one was a home run. That was on June 10th. But then he hit a single at 119.8 miles per hour. If you've ever played baseball, there are some places in the infield you're a little nervous, especially if you're not super sure of your glove when somebody's a heavy hitter because they can really drill it at you. So I just can't imagine how hard that ball would come. I mean, 121 miles per hour. What's the fastest baseball you think you've ever had come at you?
Oh, maybe like 85 or 90, something like that. It's not even close. It's 3/4 of that speed.
Yeah. And those are different. Like you can hear them coming, and the movement of them is, and you can't think about it too much. Well, you can't think; you have to react. But as it's coming to you, you think, "Well, if I miss this, it's going to smash me in my face. It's going to be a bad deal." So, anyway, if you're a baseball fan, you probably would enjoy watching that tonight or seeing the highlights at least, and watching this guy, Aaron Judge. 110.7 miles per hour exit velocity. That's kind of neat when you watch baseball these days. They have all the different metrics they put up for the pitchers. You know, they'll show you where it went, within the strike zone, and then they'll show you the speed and everything. So it's cool to watch those. Major league guys are throwing change-ups at 78 miles per hour. That's most people's fastball on their best day if they're pretty good, and that's their changeup.
So I did see a picture I thought was pretty astounding. It was Aaron Judge, and I forget the other guy's name. They're the two AL leaders right now. They were tied in runs earned. and Aaron Judge is huge. And then the other guy, I think he was playing shortstop. He came up to basically his waist. Mm. He's pretty short. But they're the two leaders. One guy's massive and the other guy's tiny. But they're sharing the lead in runs earned. And they showed the size disparity of Aaron Judge. He's just a giant there.
Well, that's one of the things I think is neat about baseball is you don't have to necessarily have the perfect size for it. You just have to be really good at it. You know, you don't have to be like in basketball. If you're not big, you're not going to play very much unless you're 6'3", but super athletic like a Russell Westbrook or somebody. Or, you know, you have to be a little bit bigger. But in baseball, not always. There are guys that aren't even 6 foot, and they're very dominant. Mm-hmm. I saw a great story over the weekend as a high school kid here in the U.S. playing baseball, and he only has one arm. Like, he's missing, I believe it's his right arm. It's completely gone. It's at the shoulder. He lost it when he was a little kid. He's a catcher, plays catcher for the team. So he catches it, he flips the ball up, drops the glove, grabs it, and throws it back. He does it super fast and puts the glove back on. He hits with one arm. And they said it's not like a charity thing. Like, he's pretty good. I mean, obviously he's limited, but he's done a pretty amazing job for just having one arm.
It is incredible how people can adapt. We would think that that's impossible, but until you're forced into a situation like that, there are some players, even who have reached the major league level, who have pitched like that. They'll cradle their glove sort of in the crook of their other arm that's missing, and then they'll just throw the ball as they follow through. They'll stick their hand into their glove that's underneath their other, like the stub on their other side. Right. And it's just a fluid motion. It's really quick, and they're actually able to field their position after making the pitch.
Yeah. Jim Abbott, I think, was one of the guys that did that. He was super fast. He could flip the glove between both hands, so... Pretty amazing. Why am I not in the professionals? I have all my appendages.
It makes you feel bad, doesn't it?
I still can't.
When you see guys like that who are just defying reality almost.
Yeah, they're just so good. They're like, I don't need all the appendages. I'm just that good. Out in California, they're having some heat and drought out there and raging wildfires. Raging wildfires across California forced nearly 8,000 to evacuate. Over the weekend, there's a heat wave. It's continuing to bake California and the rest of the West. And wildfires forced about 8,000 people to dash to safety Sunday as flames destroyed homes and threatened thousands of structures across the state. The forecast for 10 days shows no rain. So the heat and the fires continue out there. In California, they seem to just have it's interesting, though. But they had a lot of snow over the winter up in the mountains. Then they were having some flooding problems. And now it's drought and there's fires. So you can't win.
Yeah, I think California... a lot of the forests are old, and so they're kind of at that life cycle where they need to burn. That's just the life cycle of any forest. Unfortunately, we've built so much into them that it affects people's lives, the houses and the cities and all that. So, it is amazing how many fires are going on right now. I saw a map earlier, and it looked like there were 10 to 12 different fires over the place. And there's just been a lot of fires. Even in London, they had another fire the other night. So it is interesting how those just seeming to increase.
What was the one in London? Was it in like a building burned or?
Yeah, it was at I think it's called the Camden Village. It's like a shopping area, and they had it contained, but it burned down a building there.
Huh. Yeah. So firefighters have to be always busy. There is a story about some firefighters that pulled the baby deer out of the fire. That's always pretty epic. The picture of them running out with it on their shoulders. They saved the deer, so good for them. They say this next story here is about Amazon Prime. You guys Prime? You Prime Time guys? Amazon?
I love that. It's really convenient.
I used the 1 month free trial and that was it.
A lot of people do. A lot of people do. It might be time to sign up again for your freebie. We're not sponsored by them, by the way. This is just if you're interested, public service. Unless you've been living under a rock, they say, you probably know that Amazon Prime Day will happen Tuesday, July 11th, which is tomorrow. I must have been because I didn't know that until I read this. That's why I always wake up with a sore neck. The third annual sale by the e-commerce giant will feature thousands of lightning deals only available to Prime members. They will be in limited quantities and available for a limited time from kitchenware to electronics. The inventory is diverse, and you're guaranteed to find something you didn't even know you wanted. So that's what they say. So if you're a Prime Day newbie, they say here are some things to know. It is Tuesday, July the 11th, and the deals become available as early as 9 p.m. Eastern on July 10th, which is today. New deals will start about every 5 minutes for 30 full hours. So certain deals that are labeled Spotlight may return on July 11th while supplies last. So if you've got a shopping problem, this will not solve it, but it will it will aid you in your addictions. But they're having their deals. I've never really looked at the Prime Day before, but apparently there are some good deals if you need something.
Yeah, and that can really be a worthwhile service as well. Two-day free shipping is the big thing that's part of that package. And so if you're buying a lot of goods online, that pays itself off in a couple of orders pretty much. I think the cost is like $11 per month. And so if you're paying more than that in shipping per month, then it already pays itself off. But it's also one of those psychological things where maybe you convince yourself to buy more things to make sure that it pays off, and you're buying things that you wouldn't have necessarily bought before.
Yeah, for sure that can happen. Anyway, it's going to be interesting to see what people do at work, right? Got the internet sitting there. All these deals are going on. Can't focus. So that's on Tuesday and also later this evening too. So if you're a primetime player, there you go. But like they say, if you don't have it, they have that 30-day free sign up. Obviously, they're trying to get you into their membership thing, but hey, maybe it'll be something that you'd like. Here's a story from the Telegraph that's not good news. They say cancer is now more common than getting married or having a first baby. Analysis by Macmillan Cancer Support shows that there were 361,216 cancers diagnosed in 2014 in the UK, the most recent figures available. So this is in the UK. They're looking at this. It's extremely common now, more common to get cancer than to get married or to have a first baby. So I think it shows two things. One, cancer's on the rise and people aren't getting married and having babies.
Yeah, that is a disturbing trend, I think. There are a lot of disturbing health trends in the world, but that is an interesting way of looking at it, that cancer, more people deal with cancer in their life or with family members than starting their own family. So that is a terrible trend, but I think it is reflective of diet and a lot of other things we see that are more widespread. And I think President Obama gave John Kerry the permission to end cancer. Was it Joe Biden?
Whoever. It was Joe Biden. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think We kind of talk about it in terms that we need to find like the magic serum to stop cancer, when I think really it comes down to lifestyle. That can, not all the time, but I think that can prevent a lot of these problems.
Yeah, preventative measures as much as possible, because once it happens, it's kind of, you know, then you have to deal with it. They say research among more than 2,000 people for the charity also showed that cancer is the disease people feared the most, 37%. Ahead of Alzheimer's disease, 27%, stroke, 7%, depression, 4%, heart disease, 4%, or multiple sclerosis, 2%. And for 1 in 10 people in the UK, or 10%, cancer is their biggest fear of all, ahead of losing a loved one, their own death, or terrorism. So that's the biggest fear for 10%. Projections suggest that around half of people will develop cancer at some point in their lives. That's a horrible projection. They say, however, 90% of people living with cancer surveyed said they were still living their lives as normally as they could. So that's, I guess, probably where a lot of the research and development is in now, like how do you deal with it once you have it, which is not, I mean, it's not bad, I guess, to try to deal with it, but at the same time, preventing it would be even better, right? But with all the food and the pollutants and things, you just don't see a lot of reports come out about what causes it. But I think people know more than they let on.
Yeah, well, I think it's it is something that you want to have probably a little bit of privacy about for most people, but it is it would be good if there was more information how to prevent it, and if that was pushed more rather than medication or other things, because it seems like that information is out there, but it's not as heavily stressed as other medications and pharmaceutical companies having a say in that, because I think too, if you were going to advertise how to prevent cancer, it would put a lot of other industries in jeopardy,
yeah.
Like the food industry. So I think there's just a lot of pressure there. And I think that's, we should all think about the ethics of different industries that are really hurting people's lives rather than doing anything about it.
Yeah. And what's interesting usually, I think, is that a lot of people don't really look into how to try to naturally not have it until they have it. And then when you have it, oh, no, I got to do something, of course. And then people start looking sometimes at diet and things. But, you know, I'm not saying it's too late, but I mean, it's already there. So anyway, it's really, it does affect a lot of people. It's a real, one of the great scourges of our time. And they think that 50% of people will get it. I think they're looking at the UK just in this study, but some parts of the world don't get it as much. I think their diets are different.
Yeah, I think it really is important to try to focus on preventing the causes like we've been talking about instead of treating it after we've gotten it, especially if you look at some of the medical practices that deal with cancer specifically. Chemotherapy is really about bringing the body to the brink of death just so that you kill the cancer and then hoping that you can come back from the chemotherapy. It's almost like in a lot of cases, the treatment could even be worse than the cancer itself.
And I saw a report last week where they think that chemo may even spread it.
Mm-hmm.
So I haven't looked at all the details, but it's like anything, you know, the medical profession, it's a learning thing. I mean, they're learning all the time. Oh, this worked, this didn't work, so on and so forth. Here's an interesting story, too. The world's oldest hippo has died, they claim. How do you know? There might be some hippo out there that nobody – how do you know how old they are?
If you get close to one to try to find its age, it might not end well for you either.
Yeah. You see one with a walker? That one looks old. World's oldest hippo dies at a Philippine zoo. Bertha, which is an appropriate name, believed to be the world's oldest hippopotamus, died at the age of 65. The Manila Zoo said Monday, having beaten the typical lifespan for the mostly herbivorous mammals by decades. So they don't live that long usually. But again, how would you know if it was the world's oldest hippo? The oldest one in captivity. That's probably the only thing you could say. But so anyway, that one that died at 65. It's always sad when those animals die in a way because a lot of times they're big attractions, you know. And then you find out they have died. So that happened there in the Philippines. This one is terrifying. A teen was camping recently over the weekend. And he woke up and he heard crunching sounds. And those crunching sounds were a bear biting him on the head.
The crunching of his,
yes.
His skull?
Yes. Or,
oh, wow.
A teen staffer at a Colorado camp fought off a bear after waking up Sunday to find the animal biting his head and trying to drag him away. Well, that'll get you up and going. The 19-year-old woke up around 4 a.m. to a crunching sound, as he put it, with his head inside the mouth of a bear.
Oh.
You know, you have those moments where you're taking maybe a nap kind of at an odd time and you wake up and you have a few seconds of who am I, what's going on. You wake up and you would have that, you know, what is happening to me? There's a bear biting my head. Like you wouldn't put those, that wouldn't be one of your first thoughts. Is a bear biting me?
Oh, wow.
But he figured it out pretty quickly. The bear was trying to pull him out of his sleeping bag as he slept outside at Glacier View Ranch. That's 48 miles northwest of Denver, Colorado. The teen punched and hit the bear, and other staffers who were sleeping nearby yelled and swatted at the bear, which eventually left. He had been dragged 12 feet before being able to free himself. He was okay, though. But a great story. Epic story to tell.
I don't know how he lived to even say that it happened to him. If a bear is able to bite your head, they must exert so much pressure that way. I don't even know how his skull withstood that.
Yeah. And it's funny that he didn't wake up to pain. He woke up to the sound of crunching.
Right.
So, bizarre story. What a story. Again, if you were one of the people nearby and you wake up and your buddy's being dragged by a bear out of his, you know, I guess you'd think, well, how much do I like that guy? But
you might want to run.
Yeah. But no, I mean, you would, yeah, they did the right thing, I guess, to yell and freak out, and the bear took off running. But wow, amazing to be alive.
Yeah, I am impressed that everyone didn't freak out or panic. They tried to release him, and then they were successful. I'm assuming it's a black bear or something. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not sure either. I think they didn't specify in what I saw, but I would think it would be one of those guys. It's good that his buddies didn't like grab his feet and pull the other way.
Yeah.
They have like a tug of war with the guy. But yeah, that's in Colorado. They're not too far from Denver. So bears are around. They're active, and you have to be careful, especially if you're camping. They come around looking for food. And in this case, I don't know why the bear decided to go after that kid, but he did.
It reminds me of a story. Since I'm doing the canoeing, I was reading through some books I have on maritime stuff, see if I can find any cool stories to tell them. And I came across this one I had forgotten about, and Horatio Nelson, the famous British admiral who fought at Trafalgar, when he was a teenager, he went on an expedition to the North Pole. And they were there, and the ship got caught in the ice, and they were trying to figure out what to do. And at night, he slipped off the ship with his friend with a musket, the ones that take about 90 seconds to reload if you fire it once. And he fought a polar bear. He wanted to kill the polar bear so he can bring the fur back to his father. And so the captain woke up the night, he was looking for him. He saw him in the distance, and these two boys were milling around a polar bear. And he fired, and the polar bear didn't die, and he was going to try to hit it in the head with the butt of his musket. And then, but there was a little waterway between him and the bear, and so the guys retreated because the captain was yelling at them to come back. But I couldn't imagine like a 15-year-old thinking he can kill a polar bear with a musket. That just, and just the audacity that he thought he could beat it in hand-to-hand combat. I don't know. That just shows the kind of character he had. It's just a neat story.
Yeah, they were tougher guys, I guess. Or maybe they just didn't know what polar bears could do. Maybe no one had told them.
Yeah.
That thing will destroy you. Wow. Well, that's interesting.
They'd only heard about polar bears taking long naps. Didn't know they actually did anything else.
They only had seen those Coke commercials where they're really friendly. Wow, that's an interesting story. Well, you don't have to worry about that here. We don't have any polar bears in the hot Oklahoma summer.
Yeah, I tell them the story, and I have to think of why it's relevant, because we don't have ice floes or polar bears or anything. But I just tell them the... If you're finding it hard to canoe, just
think of that.
Yeah. Find some inspiration from that story.
Yeah, it's one of those stories you tell, and you really get caught up in it because it's interesting. And then at the end, you're like, well, anyway, get in the canoes, boys. You know, how does that relate to anything?
The lesson differs on an individual basis.
Right. Yeah, well, that's how you have to present it. Just give them the story and say, now think about that.
Take from it what you will.
Yeah. They're a little confused, a little, you know. But you'll break through to somebody. Somebody will be like, yeah, that was a life-changing moment for me. You're listening to Trumpet Radio Live here on 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Key of David program coming up here in a bit. Also, the Trumpet Daily Radio Show with your host, Stephen Fleury, today from Edmond, Oklahoma, talking about Bible prophecy. How come you don't hear more about that? One-third of the Bible is prophecy. So he talks about that. Make sure you listen for that program. Also, thetrumpet.com, stop and check that out. Never trust the German, that's a quote. An interview with the son of a Nazi war criminal by Brad McDonald. Really interesting story there. So read that at thetrumpet.com. Grant, you've got a write-up for us from NBC News. Educated in terror, deprogramming the children of ISIS, the children ISIS taught to kill.
This is a really disturbing situation. These are children who have been taken into UN refugee camps as ISIS mostly retreats from Iraq, but still they're dealing with these kids who have been totally brainwashed by ISIS propaganda. They've been taught how to be suicide bombers. They've been given books full of propaganda. All of their teachers taught them how to hold a weapon, how to shoot and to kill, how to fight the jihad. So there are a lot of different children now, thousands of them, who have been reared in this propaganda. The scary thing to think about is, are they really going to be able to reprogram every single one of them to understand that that ISIS propaganda was nothing but lies?
Yeah, that's a really tough situation to be in. It reminds me, I've mentioned this story before, but in reading about the Gulag, there was children born in those camps, and of course they were used by the criminal element within those camps to do some terrible things, and they were programmed in a similar way. And the author was talking to a survivor about this, of the Gulag, and said, could you get me in contact with some of those kids? I'd like to talk to them. And the person said, you don't want to find those people. And so I think about that when I hear this. I mean, what's going to happen to these kids? Can you change them, or are they too far gone? Are they a threat?
They have actually noticed at some of these refugee camps that some of the boys, mostly boys, are harboring resentment against the people who have rescued them, because they've been taught so thoroughly to believe that these outsiders, these people who are not with ISIS, if anyone comes in to get them, those are actually the bad guys. And so even though they are no longer in a miserable indoctrination camp, they still think that the people who save them, the heroes in this case, are actually the villains.
There is something very captivating, I guess, about, like, say, ISIS ideology, to some people, obviously, because you see examples even of people that have grown up in the States, have a comfortable life, and yet they want to go be part of ISIS, and a lot of times end up living very roughly and usually killing or being killed. You know, most, why would you want to do that? It seems ridiculous. Wouldn't you rather have a peaceful life? But there's something about it that pulls some people in. So you can imagine, like, if these, especially as kids, if they're brainwashed like this, if they can bring them back. Do they talk about, like, do they think they're having success, or is there any way to know?
It's going to be difficult for those trying to rehab these kids to have success, because what ISIS did was they took over all the schools and mosques in the areas where they inhabited, specifically in Iraq, but probably in these other areas too. And so even as they retreat, they have left behind all of these children who could grow to take their place one day. That's why they're scared of this whole scenario. And plus, some of these refugee camps have inhumane living conditions. It's not like they're just put in a completely better situation than the indoctrination camps were. A lot of those places are marred by filth and squalor. A lot of them are pretty violent right now. You know, some of those who are still sympathetic toward ISIS clashing with those who do not have any sympathies for ISIS. So there are some issues in the refugee camps that would make them wonder as well. Is it really so much, are we really so much better off without ISIS?
Yeah, it's hard to know, because you could tell a person to do something differently, and maybe they nod their head or they agree because they know they're supposed to, but have you really changed anything? That would be so hard to know. I don't know. Just off the top of you guys' heads, can you think of a historical situation where they've tried this and what the results have been?
Well, from what I remember, most evil civilizations we regard as evil in history have indoctrinated children. The Hitler Youth, Stalin did the same thing. In recent times, the most success they've had have been with child soldiers in Africa, where some have escaped and come to America, and they have the scars of that life, but they do have jobs and they are trying to normalize their lives. But it is a small, very, very small percentage. And so especially in these areas where you still have war going on and where the culture isn't that friendly with the United States in general anyway, where these NGO organizations are there trying to help the kids, it's very difficult, because even if you can teach them for a few months, but if you let them go back into the same environment, they can easily revert back to where they were before. So it's just really tough to do. And in many cases, unless you fundamentally change the nation and the culture they're living within, you can't really make much headway.
Yeah, it's really, the mind's an interesting thing. There's always stories about people that grew up in abusive situations, and oftentimes they try to go back to those. They'll find somebody that's the same way, and you think, wow, why wouldn't you want to get away from it? But even though it's bad, it's what they're comfortable with or something. There's a lot of reports about that. And so it's sort of similar here with this. If you're brought up being indoctrinated into a certain way, even though it's a terrible way to live, and if you're brought to the point, I don't know how far they brought these kids, but if they're brought to the point where they think they're going to die for the cause and they've accepted that, that's a different mindset than most people would have.
Yeah, and speaking of a captivating ideology, you would have to think that a radical Islamist ideology would be more compelling than whatever the Nazis and the communists were learning, because sure, they might have wanted a master race or to take over the world and be the greatest nation, but they didn't have a spiritual element behind it. They didn't have a religious cause that they thought was worth dying for in horrific ways, you know, blowing themselves to pieces and things like that. So this is something where it's a lot harder to reprogram them than even any other ideologies we've seen. You even think of North Korea today. Those people are also programmed in a certain way. They would need to be reprogrammed if we could ever get to them. But at the same time, they don't have a religious force behind that would inspire them to give up their lives for their cause as much as radical Islam would inspire these people.
Right. It is a, like you say, a spiritual element. They think that's their cause and purpose. And then too, you know, if a person is brought up or programmed in a certain way to find, say, their self value in something, a cause or a direction, and if you take that away from them, they sort of in a way you're like killing them. Because they've lost their identity and what they've constructed themselves to be. And so what are you left with? You can see why it would be as bad as the things that they've been taught are. It seems like have found some sort of, they've just found their place in that system. And once that's gone, then you're kind of like, well, what am I? Do I go and I live in the West and get a job? And, you know, it's just such a different path than what they've been brought up in.
And it must be extremely confusing for them, too, because one side's telling them that the West is evil and must be obliterated. The other side is telling them that everything they had just heard was a lie. They're very young kids. I mean, the max age probably was something like 17. So they're saying that the ages between 14 and 17 are the hardest for them to reprogram and turn them back away from this radical ideology. But we're still talking about children. And for two groups to be vehemently arguing that their side is right, the kids are going to have to figure out which one is right. And a lot of them are too young to really understand what's right and wrong. One of the brigade commanders who's fighting ISIS in Iraq offered an apt and I think a really accurate analogy. He said, speaking of these children, when a chicken lays eggs and then the chicken dies, the eggs stay and turn into new chickens. These groups have different names, but they are all the same. So, you know, in this case, if ISIS is kicked out of the area, you still have these eggs or these children who have been indoctrinated who can just grow up and carry on doing the exact same thing, beheading people, creating terror and destabilizing the entire region.
Yeah, and that's the dilemma even here with just dealing with these terror groups in general in the West is the leading voices will say, well, there's nothing wrong with your religion, but we just don't want you to act on it. Or they try to make some, they try to differentiate and say, well, the religion's different than what these people are doing. Well, yeah, some are more extreme than others, but it is going back to a religious ideology that is very much anti-West. So what are you going to reprogram to do? Like, you can still be anti-West, just don't do anything about it. I mean, it's kind of a tough deal.
Well, plus too, in the Quran, whether they think of it literal or like a spiritual analogy, a lot of it is about a caliphate. A lot of it, the history of Muhammad is establishing a literal kingdom of Islam, which is a caliphate. And so when ISIS comes along and says, we are establishing it, this is the moment all the prophets have said for hundreds of years, it's very appealing, especially if you're an Arab Islam person who have lived under the rule of other people for hundreds of years. Finally, this is our chance to make our own kingdom. So it is very appealing, depending on how you think about it, and if you realize the ramifications of all that. But on the flip side, in Iraq, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, which was ISIS before it was ISIS, they said there were 70% of the insurgents were just people looking for money. Al-Qaeda paid better than anyone else. 20% were people who wanted to fight for Al-Qaeda, but they didn't want to die. So once they got pushed to that point, they would surrender. And 10% were diehard radicals who would fight to the death every single time. And so that was kind of the makeup of Iraq 10 years ago. But with them teaching all these kids, that 10% is growing. Because even if these kids grow up and they don't do anything for a while, the next time a radical cleric says, we're going to have jihad, they're probably going to fight. Whether it's like grants under a different banner, a different cause, a different leader, the seeds have already been planted. And in a nation like that, where that happens every generation, it seems like there's a new cycle like this every generation. Same thing happens over and over again. So it is kind of it's a generational thing that has been happening for centuries. So to think that we can fix it now is we'd have to try something new that we haven't tried before.
Yeah, and they're learning from every, you know, okay, ISIS gets so far and then gets defeated. Well, you've learned something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be really interesting to see. Just going forward, we won't know, I'm sure, for a few years, but what comes of the generation that grew up in the Iraq war or in the ISIS infiltrated places, what do they become? In most cases, they are not going to become upstanding citizens of a Western nation. They have a different value system and they'll probably act out on it.
Well, even if they don't become terrorists, they do become psychologically destroyed. A lot of these kids have come into the refugee camps and are just absolutely terrified of any plane that flies overhead or any noise that they hear. Some of them have said they can see the bearded faces of ISIS terrorists in their nightmares. So they really have been haunted by what they've gone through. And that's going to take a really long time to get over, even if they genuinely do want to be upstanding members of society. How can you really live down, you know, being 6 years old or something like that and taught to murder? A lot of these kids, if they're not so friendly toward those who have saved them, they're going home, they're hitting their siblings and threatening to kill them because they're still committed to this ideology. There's a lot they have to do to try to repair these children.
Very difficult. That's from NBC News. Educated in terror, deprogramming the children ISIS taught to kill. One of the great casualties. And as you mentioned, Abraham, there are seeds actually being planted too. You got a story for us, Abraham, from TechCrunch. This is going on over in China. I would not want to do this. Four volunteers will live in a sealed lab for 200 days as China preps for its first manned moon mission. So I hope it's nice in there. 200 days, you know, you start getting a little claustrophobic, like, I got to get out of here, but you can't.
Yeah, this is really interesting because it has a law of ramifications. And so four people from China's top aeronautics university will live in a sealed laboratory for 200 days. And this is all in preparation for their first lunar mission. Only three nations have had a soft lunar landing, meaning they sent a probe to the moon. That's the U.S., Russia, and China. And so in the next 15 to 20 years, China's goal is to put men on the moon. And so this represents a pretty big threat to U.S. supremacy in space. But also it kind of shows that the baton is being passed to China and these other nations of lunar and space exploration, because NASA, they have certain things going on, but it's they haven't really done anything record-breaking in a while, since really since the Apollo program. And so this program here, it's called Yugong 1. It means moon palace.
Come to my moon palace.
And so they're going to, these four people are going to learn how to live in a system where it's has like air filters and it's not in a natural producing one like Earth's atmosphere. And so they're going to learn how to live in there, get their bodies used to it. And so they in the future, they can keep getting more and more trained for it.
It, the problem is when you open up the vault after 200 days and only two people come out, you say, where are the other two?
Oh,
and they're
no.
like, well, we don't know. What are you talking about? This sounds like a reality show. You know, they have that show where they have people in like a house and they, you know, just follow them around. And this would be interesting to see what people do over 200 days inside of the sealed lab. I guess part of it, too, is just also psychological. Like, can you handle it? Because that's one of the things I thought about for astronauts is, even if you could handle everything else, just the psychological element of I can't live out here, you know, and I can't freak out. That would crack, I think, a lot of people.
Well, and plus too, besides thinking about constant death at every turn because it is a very dangerous environment, you're in these tiny spaceships or vessels with not a lot of room. When you're with three or four people, you have to get along with them the whole time. Things can go wrong and you have to adapt. So it is, I think space flight is romanticized quite a bit. But when you get down to the basic every second living up there, it's very difficult because you're with four other guys or two or three, however many ever it is. Close quarters, you really can't do anything. You can't exercise. Your food is like the space rations. It's not real food. And so it's not an easy life. I mean, I think everyone would be committed to it if they did go up on it. But it is a tough schedule. It is a tough business to get into. And so what's interesting is the U.S. military is a little concerned about this, because if China can land men on the moon, it means that they probably have a lot of other capabilities with space and with America's military so reliant on satellites and GPS and all those sorts of communication systems. If China gets up there, we don't have any regulation, we don't have any defensive systems or anything, so it could be very dangerous. And so the U.S. military is trying to look into a way where they can wage war in space and fight against other space programs, because that's really the most vulnerable part of the U.S. military, as Editor-in-Chief Gerald Flory has said many, many times.
Yeah, it's interesting. We haven't had people. We have people up in space all the time, but not going to the moon like they had many years ago. So that's something China's looking at and racing towards. That's from TechCrunch. Four volunteers will live in a sealed lab for 200 days as China preps for its first manned moon mission. So they're just working towards it. They don't have any real concrete, I guess, dates and plans and things, or they haven't released them if they do.
Yeah, I think it's all still in the preparatory stages where I think they still have to build the spacecraft and they still have to do a lot more testing to make sure that all their equipment is up to scratch. But seeing how far China has come in such a short time, I have no doubt that they'll get there eventually. And so I think the 15 to 20 years is a pretty reasonable margin, and it could come much quicker than that.
Yeah, interesting. You have one other write-up for us here from the Washington Post. This is interesting for those that like archaeology. And it would be terrifying to find, but in some ways it seems like a movie. Archaeologists unearth a 500-year-old Tower of Skulls and another gruesome Aztec mystery. That would be... it is just like something you would find in like Indiana Jones, right? He's always digging around and finding these terrifying right. things and then these awesome things at the same time. But this is a 500-year-old Tower of Skulls. Give us the details.
Yeah, this is, I think, something that everyone is intrigued by because, like you said, it's from a movie. But it does give us some more insight into Aztec culture, and that all the accounts of the Spanish conquistadors, they're not made up, that they actually saw everything they wrote about. And so this is, I think, interesting proof, and it does provide us with some terrible imagery on what those Spaniards would have seen, what they would have encountered. It does seem something of a movie because it seems so unbelievable. So there were, in the Aztecs in the 1500s, that's when the Spaniards first got there, when they first came as friends and allies rather than enemies. And when they first got there, the thing the Spaniards... first noticed was the human sacrifice, and that was a central part of the Aztec rituals. And they found human blood everywhere, human hearts being burned in ceramic braziers, different things like that to warn people about don't mess with the Aztecs.
Message received.
Yeah, they heard tales of thousands being sacrificed at the Great Temple, like these ziggurats. Four rows of victims that stretched for miles, all waiting for their turn. One conquistador in his journal, they came across skulls and heads, and they counted 136,000 heads. They had to use multiplication because there were so many to count them. And so this is what the Spaniards would have seen. And a lot of people said, well, that's ridiculous. They weren't that brutal, or they're just making them seem worse to justify their conquest. But this, what they found here, just outside of Mexico City, is this Tower of Skulls. And so this helps confirm what the conquistadors saw. And also, this is just one Tower of Skulls. There are probably many, many others in all the big cities that the Aztecs had. And so this particular one, they found about 700 skulls.
Wow.
From different sizes and different victims.
All in one tower?
Yes, all in one place. And if you look at the pictures, it's basically just like a solid bar of dirt, if you can think of it, like a cylinder of dirt, and there's just skulls like right next to each other.
Yeah.
700 of them. And so they think this could have been a holy site, quote-unquote holy site for the Aztecs. Or something like the conquistador saw, that's like a warning when you walk into the city. And so they were found in a cylindrical edifice near the Templo Mayor, which is one of the main temples in their capital city. So this dig is still ongoing, this archaeological excavation, so they might find more, but this is the latest discovery.
Would you want to be in a dig like that? That'd be terrifying, but it might be kind of cool. Like, at least you'd know what you were looking for, right?
Yeah.
You'd be like, I know what that is.
Yeah, I mean, it is astounding discovery. And they're finding a lot of things that we don't really understand why the Aztecs did it, like that Mercury tunnel
they
found a long time ago. So we're still trying to piece together what the Aztecs were, why they did everything they did. We just have a very brief window with the Spanish, before they destroyed them, basically. So it is interesting, but it does show that it was a terrifying society, and that they were, I mean, that kind of savagery is far worse than anything we saw in contemporary Europe or the Middle East, or even what the Mongols did, some of the worst villains of history. This is something far worse. So it is interesting to think about it, and also realize that those wars fought between the Spanish and the Aztecs, it was probably one of the most brutal in history, because these are the kind of people they're fighting against.
It's amazing. Just think about growing up in that type of a culture. Like, what would your mindset be like if it was a common thing to see humans being killed all around? You would just be pretty inhuman, I would think. You would have no empathy. You'd have no compassion. It would just be very strange. I can't imagine what. It's such a fascinating society because it was so just terrible, and I think that's what sort of interests people about it.
Yeah, it is really interesting if you read through the conquistadors, their eyewitness accounts they wrote down, because the Aztecs, they had amazing architectural feats. I mean, their capital city, they made an island, they made causeways to it. It was something that even the Europeans didn't do for hundreds of years. They had done a long time ago. So they had a lot of brilliance with their architecture and different engineering feats, but at the same time, their culture was degenerative. They had the skills, but their culture wasn't uplifting, and it was just very brutal, fatalistic. And so they were a warrior culture. Their whole culture revolved around death. And so when the conquistadors fought them, there's some amazing stories. And in fact, Cortez, the Aztecs on the causeway, it's this long causeway between the capital city and the coast on this lake, near where Mexico City is today. And they were fighting, and they caught the Spanish in a trap, and Cortez was being dragged away. And one of his best friends came up and freed him, and then Cortez jumped across a little gap that had broken in the causeway. And he turned around, and his friend was being dragged away by the Aztecs, and him and four others were sacrificed on the altar.
Mm.
But his friend saved Cortez from that fate, and so his friend sacrificed his life for him. And if Cortez died, they probably all would have died, because he was the only one with the leadership capable of keeping those men together. So I just couldn't imagine. I just think of that man a lot who saved Cortez, because he knew what was going to happen to him when he did that, but he did it anyway. Mm. So that's just a high level of friendship when you've seen all these terrifying things, but you're still willing to sacrifice yourself literally for the cause. So anyway, it is interesting, but also shows that we shouldn't, in my mind, in a sense, we shouldn't be too apologetic necessarily for that these cultures are gone, because they didn't contribute anything to the human experience. If anything, they just were a terror to everyone who lived under them.
Well, I think it's good history to look at, because there's the idea in the media today and in the left especially that Western culture was some sort of a scourge on the world. Oh, really? You know, the great things that they, decry and say are outrages, well, compare them to this. The West, in a lot of cases, especially the United Kingdom and the U.S. to some extent, has brought some good things to the world. Now, of course, there's been problems, and today there's a lot of societal problems, but we have brought a lot of peace and prosperity and good things to the world. What would you have if you had the Aztecs running everything? You'd have a lot of skulls. You'd have a lot of towers of skulls, apparently.
Yeah, exactly. It's a great way. And just to put everything in perspective, I think, because even last week we talked about that story in Canada with the Mi'kmaqs protesting the way the British treated them. And there's enough blame to go around for every different people out there. But if you look at the general balance of culture, basically when the European cultures rose to power, when they made empires and when they colonized the world, they made lots of mistakes. They didn't do everything perfectly. But if you look, especially when you look at the English-speaking peoples, when you look at the institutions they brought, the idea of democracy, due process, freedom, all these things that most of the world has in some form or the other, and they take for granted. If in this case, the Spanish fought them, but if these certain cultures existed today, like the Aztecs, or even the like the Iroquois and other really brutalistic cultures, we'd have no chance that for everyone to have a chance at having a free life and a prosperous life. So there is a lot of, I think, just puts things in perspective, and we should be grateful for the institutions we do have.
We know those cultures would have absolutely welcomed a war that would have ended either side as well. They were hoping to end the European conquerors before that they got ended themselves. They were hoping for a lot of bloodshed. They got what they wanted, and yet we paint them as victims today.
Yeah, it's really interesting history. It's from the Washington Post. Archaeologists unearth a 500-year-old Tower of Skulls. Sounds like a board game or something. And another gruesome Aztec mystery. So pretty interesting. That's all the time we have for today on Trumpet Radio Live. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. Myself, Dwight Falk, Grant Turgeon, Abraham Blondeau. Have a great rest of your Monday, and we will talk to you again tomorrow.
Listening to Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG.